A proposal by AT&T, the telecommunications corporation, to construct a 140-foot-tall tower in Manchester to boost capacity for cell phone use met with opposition from both the town's select board and planning commission at a joint public hearing held at the Manchester Community Library on Tuesday, May 2nd. Board members cited both health and visual concerns about the proposal, but left the door open to continuing discussions about modifying the proposal or finding a different site in town that might be more palatable.
I think that based on everything we've heard, I would say that with respect to the current site, that we're making a negative recommendation. Now that, that is conditioned on not just trying to run AT&T out on the rail, but to entertain alternative sites. So I think what we need to do is we need to go back, because there is obviously some kind of need, either at the public service, public health level, or at the coverage level.
The select board was able to come to consensus, and we are formally expressing our opposition to construction, and we reject it and would like to explore alternate locations.
The public hearing was attended by a little more than 60 people, between those at the library's Hunter Room and others logging in remotely. It began with a presentation by Will Dodge, an attorney with the law firm of Downs, Racklin & Martin, who described the cell tower proposal, which would be built on a site off Riverside Heights near Depot Street in Manchester. Dodge said AT&T was looking to bolster the public safety communications capacity for the FirstNet system, developed in response to problems that emerged during the 9/11 emergency, when first responders had difficulty communicating with each other. The site on Side Road was the best they could find that would improve signal strength. Potentially, the height of the tower might be reduced to 100 feet, he said.
And statewide, you can see that there are some state agencies like VTrans, the Vermont State Police, Department of Health, Agency of Natural Resources, National Guard, and locally, there are a lot of subscribed FirstNet users, including the Sheriff's Department, who have cell service in downtown Manchester today. Why are you trying to build a tower near Depot Street? And the answer has to do with capacity. So this is a little bit of a confusing map, but if you get oriented with me, you'll see that you've got Route 7 here, and you've got Route 11 and Route 30, so basically the neighborhood that we're in now. And what this is showing in different colors is where your cell service for AT&T is coming from today. And that includes most of it coming from the tower over on Beckley Street, which is a 185-foot tower. Another one in Peru, a 140-foot tower. One, and actually two in Dorset. So really there's only one tower that AT&T has in Manchester proper. The rest of the service is coming from sites that are basically 4 to 7 miles away. And the issue that we're having, and the reason that we, and you can kind of see where some of those adjacent sites are located. There's Beckley Street right there. Here are the ones up in Dorset. The one over here is in Peru. And the others are basically too far to be providing service. The issue is that Highway 7A serves 4,500 vehicles a day. And State Highway 3011, Depot Street, has roughly 10,000 vehicles per day. And that measurement is just based on averaging. So there's times of the year, especially the summer, Christmas, holidays, where the traffic on that road is so great and everyone is trying to use their phones. So even though you might see that you have service, the effect is your phone's not working. It'll be spooling or you won't be able to send a text. And when that happens, not just for intended users, but for first responders, that's a big problem.
After his presentation, Select Board and Planning Commission members asked a few questions.
The question is, you mentioned that you can go down to 100 feet. Can you go incrementally from 140 to 100?
We could go down to really at any 10-foot interval. And here's why it's a great question. Part of what happens in wireless technology is that if you have multiple carriers, each one needs to be separated from the next one by 10 feet. So if AT&T, let's say, puts it antennas, the antennas are usually 8 feet. So if they are at, if we have a 100-foot tower and we're at our center line is at 96 feet, then the next party who would be above us would be at 106 feet, et cetera, all the way up to, let's say, 130. I think that we're comfortable right now going to 100 feet and thinking that that will work for the immediate needs that we have. The tower will have more capacity if we build it to 120, but the other way to do, so in other words, it'll be much easier for another carrier, let's say a Verizon or a T-Mobile, to come and put on if that extra 20-foot section is already built. But we could simply add it later.
AT&T endorse it?
Correct.
The tower you have here in town, do you guys own that tower or do you pay rent for it?
We pay rent.
So if you built this other tower, you wouldn't have to pay rent, is that correct? Because you own the tower. You would just pay to the landlord?
So we would pay the landlord. We would own the tower more than likely very briefly and then sell it. So AT&T is not in the business, as paradoxical as it sounds, of owning a lot of towers.
Then it was the turn of the audience to weigh in, which was basically an unbroken series of concerns and requests to build a tower someplace else.
You went through your alternative sites rather quickly, and so I'd like to dwell on a couple of those that I don't understand really why they were rejected, or they just aren't quite as good as convenient. And also, I didn't hear or past didn't see anything about what we referred to as the old airport site, which I think has, well, would have possibility, but it's also beneficial, is that the town owns that property, and then they could be beneficiaries of potential revenue. So was that site looked at all?
And my concern is that, and I appreciate the question, and you know, as AT&T typically does after these types of meetings, if suggestions come up that are viable, or even if they're not viable, we'll look into whether they're, you know, it's a possibility. I think that the reason that we probably didn't look at it was, again, because we started to see that the way that the OI district is drawn, as you get further away from the Battenkill and further away from Depot Street, you end up closer to other residential neighborhoods that are right on it. And that's not, you know, that's by no means unique to Manchester.
That is our view. That is our mountain that is going to be just basically destroyed the view by putting that tower. That red balloon, I looked out my deck and I looked at it several weeks ago. I didn't even know what it was. No one gave us any kind of notice. It's just because they had to give notice to one of my neighbors who owns the field behind me that we even found out about this. And, you know, I can guarantee all of our property values will be affected by that kind of a view. And what Bill said, the entire town. So you've got to find second best.
And the engineering technology, we all need cell phones, but let's put it kind of outside our community in a larger area that will service us, but doesn't sit in the middle of town.
Hi, good evening. My name is John Burnham, the executive director of the Manchester Business Association. And when this proposed cell tower was put out there in the news, you know, we felt it was important to ask our 130-member businesses, the majority of them here in Manchester, you know, a simple question, you know, would you approve, yes or no, to the proposed cell tower? Out of the 37 respondents, which is about 30% of our total members, about 59% of them supported the building of a cell tower. Nine were no, so about 24% of those total respondents, and six were kind of didn't really care either way. But all were, the majority anyway, did have concerns as has been expressed this evening. So
why do we choose places where people don't have a voice to have cell towers? And what happens in terms of the Manchester community once people get sick and what are the costs going to be once the radiation moves into the population?
The more than two-hour-long meeting ended with the Select Board and Planning Commission making negative recommendations about the proposal. The Select Board and Planning Commission opposition to the present plan is simply one step in a potentially longer process. Town officials will draft a letter to the state's Public Utility Commission, which will have the final say on the proposal. The PUC typically grants substantial deference to local community concerns, but is not obligated to agree, and could go ahead and issue what's known as the Certificate of Public Good anyway. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. It wasn't exactly a groundbreaking or a ribbon-cutting ceremony, but more of a foundation-pouring ceremony, as progress towards the completion of Hildene's new Lincoln Hall was marked and noted. When finished in approximately 1 year from now, in May 2024, the 14,000-square-foot building will house space for civics and educational programming, as well as special events like weddings, replacing the former tent that used to sit between the Welcome Center and the residence where Robert Todd Lincoln and his family used for a summer home starting in 1905. A crowd of about 40 people, including trustees of Hildene, former trustees, staff, representatives of the construction and architectural firms involved in building it, along with other friends and dignitaries, assembled above the construction site where the work was underway to hear from several speakers, beginning with Hildene's president, Brian Keefe.
So, well, we do have a first-rate cultural heritage site. It's long been a goal of our trustees and our members to create a first-class event facility to advance our mission and create new opportunities. Today we are here to formally launch Lincoln Hall, our 14,000-square-foot four-season assembly building. This structure will be a transformational asset to our campus. It is the largest and most significant capital construction project at Hildene since Robert and Mary completed what they would call their ancestral home in 1905. All of this has been a vision for our Board of Trustees, and it is exciting to see this come to fruition.
He was followed by Ken Moriarty, the chairman of Hildene's Board of Trustees.
We as trustees gave some thought to this a number of years ago. What really is Hildene's purpose? Yes, we've got this gorgeous home. We've got these beautiful grounds. But as Brian just alluded to, at its heart, Hildene exists to bring Abraham Lincoln's values to future generations. And to do this through a lot of education and a lot of inspiration, so that people can see that they can make these Lincoln values that are at the heart of what it means to be an American and make it their own. We call that values into action. And Lincoln Hall is going to be instrumental in helping us to achieve that purpose for Hildene that we are also proud of.
They in turn were followed by Tom Deck and Ivan Beatty, representing Manchester Village and the town of Manchester.
I think the Lincoln family would really be proud of what it has become today. I think that resonates with us. We should all be very proud. In many ways, the Hildene is almost a cultural epicenter for what happens here in Manchester.
But from someone who grew up here, from an institutional family, it means a lot to me to see this preserved and growing and becoming what it needs to be in these modern times. And thank you, Brian.
We caught up with Brian Keefe after the ceremonies were over.
Yeah, we'll be doing a lot of education programming along some of the agricultural and regenerative agriculture and pollinators and a lot of the ecological practices that we have around here, but also a lot of civic engagement things. We have our annual Lincoln Essay Competition, which is an eighth grade essay contest that we'll be able to have more in-person event part of that. And we really, the civil discourse is something that we really want to get our teeth into. And up until this point, we really haven't had a facility to have some of those discussions, and this will have that ability. There's also the wedding business component of it, which will help us
with our bottom line, frankly, hosting weddings and having a place that is really befitting the splendor of this beautiful part of Vermont nestled between the mountains.
When finished, Lincoln Hall will be the largest new structure built on the Hildene campus since the original home, built nearly 120 years ago. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The ribbon, or maybe it was the flibbon, was cut Friday afternoon on May 12th to mark the opening of the new Vermont flannel shop on Depot Street in Manchester.
Let's do it.
Three, two, one.
Nope.
Cut.
Go for it.
Camera ready.
It's a testament to the quality of our flannel.
Getting there.
It's going.
There we go. It's going.
The shop sells classic Vermontish flannel shirts along with other products and is one of six stores the company has around the state. The shop started off last year at another location further down Depot Street, and that worked out well enough to encourage them to take over a building that had sat vacant at the corner of Cottage Street for a while. Matt Harrington of the Southwestern Vermont Chamber of Commerce and John Burnham of the Manchester Business Association helped with the opening of the new store.
We're so excited to have Vermont Flannel here in Manchester, right here in Bennington County. And we just so appreciate you guys setting up shop. And we want to see our businesses grow to this size and this popularity. But it starts somewhere. And we believe as a Chamber of Commerce that needs to be celebrated. And every new location needs to be celebrated. So with that, we've worked with J.K. Adams out of Dorset. And we just want to present this to you both as a commemoration of just saying, make your mark here on this day. And just to, so it reads to everybody. Presented to the Vermont Flannel Company, Friday, May 12, 2023, Manchester Center, Vermont, in commemoration of your grand opening and ribbon cutting. So guys, thank you so much. And with that, we'll pass it off to John.
Back in late October, early November, when I heard that Vermont Flannel was actually coming to town, even on a temporary basis, I can tell you, I was super excited. A brand like Vermont Flannel fits exactly what Manchester needs and wanted. And I knew at the moment it was only temporary, but I knew it was going to be so successful because not only do they have a phenomenal brand, but this is a phenomenal location that they would stay permanently. And so we're delighted to have this beautiful new store opening here on Depot Street. And I wanted to thank the team at Vermont Flannel for being here, for being in Manchester, and we're here to support you in every which way we can. So thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thank
Congratulations.
You thank you.
Shortly before the opening ceremony, we had a chance to talk with Joe Van Diemen, the CEO of Vermont Flannel, about what prompted them to open in this location.
Sure, we had a pop-up down the street just a few blocks down, and it was a great temporary space for us. However, we felt this building was a great fit for our brand, just the open air, the view, the light that we have in here, and really allowed us to spread out and get some walking traffic coming in the door here as well. Right. Well, Vermont Flannel Company is actually the inventor of the flannel lounge pant. So that's what we're really known for, going back to the early 90s. So those are definitely a staple. We have shirts for men and women. We have hooded pullovers, and then our blankets are very popular as well as a number of other flannel accessories, anything from different types of hats. We have boxer shorts, bathrobes, all sorts of things. Just about anything you could want in flannel, we make it. We plan on having a good presence here and be an open as part of the retail community.
Vermont Teddy Bear, another Vermont retailer, will be sharing some of the space at the new location, where we chatted with brand manager Cassie Clayton and how they came to partner with Vermont Flannel.
Teddy Bear has entered into a new partnership with Vermont Flannel, and so that kind of has started with their new retail store locations, and we're going to be a featured product in their locations that you can come one-stop shop, get your Vermont Flannel, but also get in another amazing Vermont product in Vermont Teddy Bear stuffed animals. Yes, we have a factory located in Shelburne, Vermont, where we make our classic animals and then we stuff and finish our wildlife animals, like our elephants and dinosaurs and koalas. And we also have some other exciting new products in the works that will be a kind of a formal collaboration with Vermont Flannel and Vermont Teddy Bear.
The new Vermont Flannel and Vermont Teddy Bear store will be open 7 days a week and just in time for the summer season. For the GNOT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. More than one element or ingredient goes into making a community a strong or resilient one. We continue with a series on strong towns that we began last year that explores what characteristics make some towns overcome hardships, which could be economically driven or through a natural disaster, by taking a look at Wilmington, Vermont. Some communities lose a key business or industry, which also served to give their town a sense of identity, and struggle with the loss of those good-paying jobs for decades. In Wilmington's case, it was the impact of Tropical Storm Irene in August of 2011 that buffeted the town, flooding its downtown. But the town came back from this natural disaster, drawing upon the willingness of residents to step up and help out their neighbors. And through local leadership, whether in local government, the business community, or other social institutions or organizations. We spoke with four community leaders who gave us their take on what spurred the recovery and where the town is at now, starting with bookstore owner Lisa Sullivan, the owner of Bartleby's Books, located right on Route 9, near to where the north branch of the Deerfield River flows through town.
So I was from Rhode Island. My husband was from Connecticut. We knew some people who had owned a house up here, and I'd been traveling for work and living. We'd been living in North Carolina and then San Francisco. And so we originally ended up coming here because we had traveled here and thought we'd buy a second home here. We didn't have a first home, but we thought this might be a place that we could land, and we moved here and then we never left.
What's your sense of Wilmington like as a town? Is it the sort of place that, you know, is a resilient kind of community, would you say, or how would you characterize it?
I think it is a resilient community. I think we've had some hardship. I think certainly in Irene, in COVID, there have been a number of things. And I think it's a town where people really do the work, you know, show up, help each other. What I've always seen is kind of an outsider at first. We've lived here 21 years, maybe. If anyone is sick, if anyone is in need of help, the town and the area really rallies around that. And so when Irene happened, it was kind of the first time I think I saw the town rally around something bigger, and it was really the rebuilding of downtown. So I do think it is pretty resilient. I think you got a lot of doers.
So the river just up the way here, that was the one that flooded out pretty badly during the storm?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Flooded most of the buildings in the downtown, including this one.
This is the high water mark.
That's the high water mark.
Wow.
And so I think you have some people in town who aren't necessarily in positions of authority, like in the town, who do step up. And we had an incredible amount of fundraising done. We had an incredible organization of cleanup during Irene. We had a lot of, and that wasn't necessarily just coming from people in town positions or, you know, the top of an organization or something like that. It was just people who live here who cared. But there are some strong people and also in our government positions, our associations, like our Chamber of Commerce. I think we have good participation for the most part in our boards and our committees.
Then we met up with Gretchen Haverluck, who currently works as the economic development consultant for the town of Wilmington. She described what she did during the early days following Irene.
I immediately came in and started helping. I was volunteering for the police department, who had closed off West Main Street. And so I was issuing little tags where people could enter their properties, and volunteers could go down and help muck out with proper equipment. So masks, gloves, you know, all of those kind of things. No shorts. I volunteered for 3 weeks doing that. And then the town of Wilmington hired me to help businesses go door to door and get them the resources that they needed. Then from there, I actually was hired by the SBDC to do the same thing in Windham County and Lower Windsor County. So I did that for another year. And then the town actually hired me on as their part-time economic development consultant. So I've been working on multiple projects and really trying to bring business to our vacant buildings. We have one here across the street that, you know, has historic tax credits through the state and federal. And he's over there working, and he has a retail business coming in to start up. So all kind of exciting things. It's taken many more years than I had anticipated. However, it's really difficult being, because they're all still in a flood zone and they all need flood insurance. So I was very instrumental in helping Dot's Restaurant reopen and rebuild. And again, that was due to crowdfunding. You know, like, people wanted to see that come back, and people responded to that with actual money and cash. We have a huge second homeowner population here. It's actually about 70% of our grand list are second homes. And without them, they're a huge part of our community, obviously. And they really contributed a lot of money to see Wilmington come back. So after the Tropical Storm Irene, we did become a downtown designated organization, and that's called Wilmington Works. And so they have a part-time paid staff. I'm part-time paid staff. Between the two of us, we are able to really help all of Wilmington, because that's my focus. And of course, the other coordinator is focused on the downtown. But bringing resources to businesses is vital. It's key. And those resources come locally. So like, I stand up programs like facade improvement program, tax stabilization program, a revolving loan fund program to get people to open businesses. It's a $20,000 grant. These things are key to your local piece. Those are all paid through the 1% local option tax that we implemented again after Tropical Storm Irene. And bringing those, so from local to regional, like the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation has multiple business opportunities, that resources that really help those businesses as well. And of course, state and federal programs like the tax credit, historic tax credit, and federal tax credits are key to helping a small community like ours rebuild and redevelop. And we still use all of those resources to help these new businesses. And again, I feel like we are in a transition like we were in the 70s. We have many businesses that have really aged out, and new younger people are coming in and purchasing. And it's maybe that they're recreating an older business to make it more modern. So for instance,
then we had a chance to talk with Meg Stoloff, who is currently working with the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation as the manager of their Southern Vermont Economy Project. She formerly worked with Wilmington Works as a program coordinator. Wilmington Works was created in an effort to aid in restoring the vibrancy of Wilmington's downtown after Tropical Storm Irene.
I think Irene was an opportunity that we saw to kind of say, you know, let's take this opportunity to get together and make a plan for how to have a better, stronger, more resilient town. Because, you know, Irene was an incredibly visible disaster that, like, you know, literally, physically kind of wreaked havoc across the downtown and the historic buildings. But there's been other kind of slow moving economic trends, demographic trends that existed before that symbolic flood that really kind of had made our whole region and Wilmington in particular kind of step back and take a look and say, what direction do we want to head in? Who do we want to be? How can we be more resilient? Because we can't just have, like, if there's a couple of bad snow seasons, and that means now we have no, you know, we have less tourism, and that's, you know, I mean, a whole bunch of businesses go out of business, or people have left town, or, you know, looking at our just overall demographics, these things were happening. And there was already a sense of awareness in the town that, like, we need to figure out how to be more resilient, have a more resilient and vibrant community and economy. And so sometimes what happens is after a disaster, there was this opportunity for everybody to really pull together and get on the same page. There was, yes, there was funding, like always good to help put these buildings back together, but it also really helped to channel a lot of this idea that there was a need to really get organized about becoming more vibrant and resilient together. And so, you know, that's carried on. It didn't go away after Irene. I think it really also the lessons that we learned during Irene really helped the town sail through COVID really well too, because we already had kind of an established network. We had, you know, one of the things about having a downtown organization is that you really have contact with all the business owners. Like, you've kind of formed an identity of like, hey, you are like our downtown business owners. You know, we know who we are, you are, and we know how to get a hold of you. So that, you know, when COVID struck, we were able to really like, hey, let's all just get on some Zoom calls and talk about what are we going to do? What are you doing? How can we get you hooked up with any assistance that you need from various funding structures? But then also, like, how are we going to communicate, you know, as town is reopening, how do we want to communicate with people that are visiting? So we took a lot of those lessons learned. And I think that's been another really good lesson too, is that, like, if you create the structure in a town, like, before there's a disaster, even when there is a disaster, you'll be much better equipped to handle it. So it really helped the organization and the town really sort of develop a broad base of community support from, you know, both people who are locals who live in town and second homeowners who really love the town and, you know, visit often. We had the communication channels with them. So, you know, when there's something like COVID or just in general, there's a downtown event, you can tell people about it. If you have a group of people who are working together towards a common goal of having a vibrant downtown and vibrant business district and making the town a place where people want to be, you can do so much for a town. And whether you're in, you know, Wilmington, Vermont, or, you know, a small town in, I don't know, Kansas, it's really just kind of a way of saying, like, we have an identity, this is a town, it's a great place, and knowing about the businesses in the town, working to keep the buildings as much as possible, you know, owned and in repair. Obviously, you don't have total control over that, but there's things, you know, you can, there's resources available for tax credits and things like that to help keep buildings in redevelopment.
And finally, we stop by the Wilmington Town Hall to hear from Scott Tucker, Wilmington's town manager.
But Wilmington primarily is concentrated in second homes, about 62%. And there's a lot of restaurants here and other retail based on what tourists may like to see, you know, and experience here. So it's a very historical town. You look around and you can see a lot of buildings that still exist. You're sitting in a historical building right now at Town Hall, but a lot of the buildings were probably built in the late 1800s here. I came on probably in 2017. But by that time, most of the town had recovered. We're still working on a couple of businesses who may be getting a loan through the FEMA program and things of that nature. But by and large, everybody had recovered pretty quickly. I think within a year in particular, a couple of years, there was a lot of stories around Dots, restaurant right across the street, and how that was torn down and rebuilt. And it's rebuilt, you know, with the understanding that it could withstand another flood. So it sits right next to the river, and you could see how the water, there's a lot of pictures about the water coming down and around that whole area, and particularly here. I think we lost one person near the elementary school, and there's a bench over on South Main Street commemorating her life. And that was a tragic loss for the town of Wilmington. Basically, yeah, I mean, if you look around, you can't tell. I mean, the only reason you can tell is people still remember it. It's just as vibrant to folks who've lived here all their lives or who've had businesses downtown who had to go through that experience. But it's still in people's minds, but the recovery, I think, is pretty sound.
What do you think is the kind of the, you know, the ingredient that separates communities that, you know, kind of get back on their feet again quickly after a major setback or an economic problem versus those that wallow in misery for a few decades instead?
Well, I think it has to do with the people, especially right after Irene, where people stopped. I mean, I heard stories of folks stopping with their kids just to help out. You know, they see a lot of mud and a lot of different debris around somebody's business or home, and they just stopped and helped because they saw somebody out there, and they would ask the owner if they could help that day and things like that. So I think it's a mindset. I also think when we have so many visitors here and so many tourists and so many second homes, that people want, they're here for a reason. They want to get away from, you know, the larger cities and things of that nature, and they want, and they're more community minded. We have folks who have been involved in boards and committees, and, you know, select board members and school board. Many of the people who are still here living today and who've been here probably for the last 50 years or all their lives have participated in one way or another as a volunteer in local government. And so you also have the fact that I think we're in a pretty unique area with two lakes and a skiing industry and hiking and biking. There's a lot of things to do outside, and that's a lot of why people come to Vermont, is for the quality of life. I know that's an overused phrase, but truly it is the Vermont way and the quality of life that we have here that's second to none.
Strong towns and communities are built in a number of ways, with a sense of community being at the core. Local leadership is another key, both from the town government and business levels, but also, we are learning, from the willingness of ordinary folks to step up and make their contribution. These ordinary folks then become extraordinary. We'll be back to look at more communities and what makes them resilient and special. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.